We were working with the, we started with the image of Sophia with the crown of 12 stars and adorned like a bride and bridegroom. And actually, I wanted to, meant to show you this last time and I didn't, so I'll pass this around. Here's just some paintings of, that's a picture from the Book of Revelation. Of the woman who with radiance as of the sun, you can see the sun, and standing on the moon with 12 stars. And then the other reference in the text was the New Jerusalem. There's a picture, it's a Dore etching. And I think you can see from both of them how it's emphasized that the imagery is up. You see how high they are here? And you can see here she's above, and then the dragon's below. That's what we were talking about. And then you might just want to have a peek, because we'll be talking about it later today. There's also a picture here that we'll be referring to, the Book of Revelations, where there's seven lampstands, and the apocalyptic Christ is in the center. So just for your reference, you can have a look, see what goes. So that led us into a discussion of those dynamics. That led us into a discussion of Jung's astrological interpretation of history, in which the two sides of the God image determined the two phases of history as he saw them, the first 1,000 years and the second 1,000 years. First 1,000 years being spiritual, second 1,000 years being material. And where we are today is the end of that second 2,000-year phase, where we need to bring those two together, and hence Sophia. I did find the quote which I was thinking of, and I'll just read it to you, which in a way sums up his view of the evolution of religious, I guess, of religious worldviews. It's very short, but it's a very, very rich statement if you let it work on you for a minute. And this is from Nietzsche's his seminar on Nietzsche's Art, through stroke, page 40. The subsequent stage of religious thought is always the interpretation on the subjective stage. I'll read that again because it's so pithy. The subsequent stage of religious thought is always the interpretation on the subjective stage. And what's that mean? I mean, the implications are pretty powerful. That there are stages of religious development. And that in order to move forward in the evolution of the religious development culturally, the existing understanding must be seen psychologically. And when it's ready to be seen psychologically, it can be integrated. And when it can be integrated, then the next revelation can occur. It's kind of what we were talking about. He just says it so well in one sentence. And of course, it implies then that new stage will eventually be in a position to be taken on the subjective stage, to be interpreted on the subjective stage. So that's how you understand religion evolves. Not that religion is only psychological, but the way we experience it is always in a psychological form. And that is psychologically relevant. And when that's understood, then a new revelation can take place. That revelation will generally be believed in until such time as it's ready to be integrated. And so we are definitely at one of those crossroad periods where the old isn't working for more and more people. So that means that it can be integrated psychologically, hence the relevance of the Sophia material. Just a quote, putting in other words what we said last time.
Jeremy, just read it one more time.
Yeah. The subsequent stage of religious thought, you can really say religious imagery, subsequent stage of religious thought is always the interpretation on the subjective stage. So that a revelation is always fated to be understood psychologically. And before that, it's believed in, and then it's understood. We are in a position now of understanding. The images that we talked about were the black cloud In other words, that the first result of an experience of Sophia is going to be a depression. And the other image that was that we also discussed that was sort of very parallel to that was the image of the water inundating.
Water what?
Inundating, a flood. So that storm and flood symbolism belongs to the first stage of the Sophia experience. Then we talked about the difference between knowledge and wisdom in that medieval formulation of Hugh St. Victor, which I think was right around 1100, something like that, 1050, 1100, in which he distinguished between the imagination, which is fueled by desire, and when that meets understanding, you've got knowledge. And revelation, which is when a divine revelation, I guess, meets understanding, you've got wisdom. So for our purposes, what was so important was that there was a distinction between knowledge and wisdom. And what we're coming to in the Sophia experience, that there is no difference.
So
there is no difference. He distinguishes above and below, and what we've seen is that the above comes from the below. That's the basic distinction, basic difference. That the divine isn't only heavenly. It's also embedded in the instinct. That's the new idea. Then we talked about the Ethiopian as another image of the darkness, but more manageable. And that's where we stopped. Does that all sound familiar? Probably sounds crazy, huh? What we're doing, we're interpreting a text which is thought to be the visions of St. Thomas Aquinas on his deathbed.
Oh.
And these are all images from those visions. And it's what's so important about the visions is even though he was a classical Christian in the medieval sense, his visions, as she's interpreting, this author we're studying, she's interpreting, they are predictive of the religious change we're going through now, where there's an evolution in spiritual consciousness. So that's what we're doing.
This is Robert's library.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Nancy, you mentioned one thing, a book which the title of which I didn't get, and I wanted to follow up on.
Oh,
that.
Oh, Paul Torrance's book.
What's it called?
Passion of the Western Mind.
Oh, okay.
There's a new one coming out which is a sequel to that on feminine. Mm. It says the first Western civilization to this point is in the development of the masculine and not feminine.
Mm-hmm.
Passion of the Western Mind.
Passion of the Western Mind. Mm-hmm. I think it's January 2005. It's a history book is what it is, but he uses, he's Jungian in his approach, so when you read it.
Yeah, he teaches at the California Institute for Integral Studies.
So he's called Ms. Tarnas, T-A-R-N-A-S, Paul Tarnas.
And we left off at page 223, which I will read to you again. The text goes, "For this cause I have labored night by night with crying. My jaws are become hoarse. Who is the man that liveth, knowing and understanding, delivering my soul from the hand of hell? They that explain me shall have eternal life, and to him I will give to eat of the tree of life, which is in paradise, and to sit with me on the throne of my kingdom." Now the key idea there is that whoever's speaking, and as you've seen, it's not always clear who is speaking. Sometimes you can see that it's Thomas or whoever's having the vision. Sometimes, more likely, it's Sophia who's speaking. And here I would say it's Sophia in her dark aspect that's speaking. And it is not consistent. But that's the nature of anybody who is swamped by the unconscious. They are a bundle of sayings that if you ever stopped, if they ever stopped to look at it, would see there is one contradictory sentence after the other. But they don't see it because there's no ego there. They're swamped by the unconscious. So that's something you kind of have to get used to when you work with unconscious material, is ask yourself, who's talking? Because it won't tell you. And then the other text, which we're going to look at in connection with that, is on page 224. He that shall dig for me as money and obtain me as a treasure, and shall not disturb the tears of my eyes, and shall not deride my garment, shall not poison my meat and my drink. Now that's quite difficult. Let me go through again. He that shall dig for me as money and obtain me as a treasure, and shall not disturb the tears of my eyes, shall not deride my garment. So that's one of the main images we'll be looking at, this idea that there's a garment on Sophia, and it can be defiled. And that's something we have to watch out for. And shall not poison my meat and my drink. So the image of poison there is related, because there's this a voice which can be damaged. So we'll look at these together.
I was kind of interested in that bottom of the page, too, of 224, where it talks about and beware of increasing the fire.
Yeah, we'll get there.
Oh, okay.
Very, very important. First thing I want to look at is the image of crying out for understanding. And as they say on page 224, she says on page 224, the prima materia, crying out in distress, or its hidden spirit or soul, is none other than wisdom herself. Wisdom, therefore, according to our text, has not only come down to man, as in the Bible, but has become sunk in matter and finds herself in distress and darkness. Now, that's not saying anything new, but it's using a different set of vocabularies. What's the saying that we've already been saying? Right. That in that despair, in that depression that follows out of this encounter, there's a message. And the depression itself wants to be understood. The despair itself wants to be understood. So where we think of depression and despair as something to get rid of, generally, sometimes it is. But sometimes it is the first manifestation of an insight. And therefore, what we have to do is learn to be quiet and be receptive to its need. Nothing new. It's just this idea that the first manifestation of the thing is often in a disagreeable form. And that what we have to do is be receptive to finding the higher level that it's aiming for and hearing that. And I think, you know, the higher level that it's aiming for is the shift in both in his personal view. Anyone who has a cell phone that is off gets hung up by their toes.
Oh my God!
That's so right here in my ear.
That is so unusual.
Stop now. Hello?
I told you my fake cell phone story. I'll tell you my fake cell phone story. I have a fake cell phone. I refuse to get a cell phone. But sometimes I feel I feel lonely without a cell phone. So I got this $1.95 cell phone at Marsh, and I walk around. I pretend I'm talking. It's called stage phoning, and it's for kids. You know, it's got each button plays a different song. So a friend of mine's son was in made a movie here at one of these film festivals, and I was invited to the premiere. So I took my. I forget if there's ever a place where there's it's cell phone land. It's the premiere of a movie. So I was walking around all the other snobs talking on my cell phone. I put it in my pocket, and we got prime seats because we were sort of VIPs for this movie, and we went in and sat down. As the movie started, some change fell out of my pocket. So I bent over to get the change, and my cell phone fell out. And in picking it up, I pushed Yankee Doodle Dandy. I couldn't stop it. Fortunately, they're still my friends.
I
still have the toy. I did.
Very good.
Okay, that's not so difficult. The next passage. Again, I don't think it's difficult, but what we have to get used to is the very bizarre way that the text speaks in images. And it speaks in images with references that we wouldn't ordinarily know. And what she's done for us is help us see the context of these references. So the context of the reference for garment is alchemical. So that's where she's going here. So let's read what she says. 224, 1, 2, 3, 4 lines down. The atmosphere of defilement and violation refers in all probability to the dangers often mentioned by the alchemists of applying too much fire or too violent putrefying procedures and thus destroying the prima materia instead of cleansing it. This could be interpreted psychologically as too strong a desire to drag the unconscious contents to light. They have to be handled with a certain amount of tact, and all either or interpretation should be avoided. A little further down. The garment that must not be derided is, in alchemical terms, the body of the ore, the darkness whose removal as preparation for the work already played a role in Greek alchemy. Go down a little bit further, a little bit more than half the page. First, you must tear off this garment which you wear, this cloak of darkness, this web of unconsciousness, this prop of evil, and so on. That's how it would sound in an alchemical recipe. But so the point there is that garment would again be another image for the storm, for the Ethiopian, and now it's the garment. How do you know that that's how to interpret it? Well, because we've assumed this alchemical background for these visions. And that garment would be a typical representation in alchemy for the fact that these Sophia experiences, or any transformative experience, but in our case the Sophia experience, comes cloaked in another affective state, which at first doesn't seem to have anything to do with the deeper message, but through perseverance you get to the deeper message. What the text is saying is that you have to be gentle with this depressive state and not try to force yourself out of it, because it only seems like a first state. You won't get to the second state until you have been able to receive and gently remove that garment. I can think just where I've worked, let's say, with a spouse or with a marriage, and you just see this relationship is so sick. Why don't you get out? And everything in you wants to say that. But you can't, because it won't be heard. It may take years before that insight can occur. And you just have to wait very patiently, picking apart that depression, picking apart the dissatisfaction, until one day they say, you know, this relationship's sick. I'm getting out of it. I just saw somebody take 10 years to do that. And now they're getting out of that relationship. And I think that's, for those of us with a kind of a therapeutic enthusiasm, it's a real danger that we go way too fast and don't realize that this dark content really has a timeline of its own. And, you know, to our psychological categories, it seems foolish. Why can't you see that? But the content has its own rhythm and its own laws. So the garment does have to come off, but it has to come off gently. And generally, when you're watching people, you know, in that garment, they're doing very stupid things in their lives, which again, your rationality wants to come in and correct them. I think sometimes you actually have to if it's very, very serious, so that they don't really damage their lives. But as much as possible, allow that thing to have its own course of action. And that, I think that's kind of one of our trademarks is this not being in a hurry to try to change that thing. Another description of that dirty garment is on page 226. The dirty garment there at the bottom. They also signify exposure to autoerotic affects and fantasies which threaten to gain the upper hand when consciousness is in the greater state of association. So when a person's depressed, you know, they can fall into all sorts of sexual fantasies, weird desires for power and prestige, because it's the psyche bringing in the other side to get them out of that dark stuff. And again, you have to handle that with a great deal of tact, the book is saying.
Gary, just to kind of go back, this last couple of weeks, I've really done a lot on receiving the word sublimation.
Yeah.
And it's kind of in throughout here quite a bit. I mean, I kind of went on my own studies to kind of share with this guy a little bit. But sublimation, if I'm understanding correctly, that's when a solid form that goes to a gas state without going through the liquid, missing it.
Yeah.
So how does that, I mean, because...
Good question. Yeah, you ever notice, like, even when it's cold, snow can disappear? Because it sublimes. Because, right, it goes right into vapor. It doesn't have to turn into water.
Okay, how does that relate, though, as far as, I think I'm trying to grasp on, I've kind of gotten this a little bit of a rising motion forward.
You could say, in a way, this whole book's about sublimation, but let's distinguish different types of sublimation. See, the I think it will make sense if I contrast it with the Freudian idea of sublimation. And that is that you have this lower instinct, and which can't be satisfied. And so you try to find a higher expression for that lower instinct, which still gives it some measure of satisfaction.
Right, so as opposed to acting out, let's say, an addiction, going
right.
up higher.
Right, okay. One, of course, acting out would be the opposite of sublimation.
Right.
I think, you know, the classic example is the frustrated school mom who is not married and then puts all her caring into the classroom. That would be Freudian idea of sublimation. And the idea is that you know, you really want the other thing, but you don't get it. And so you get a higher form which is analogous. And because it's analogous, it offers you some satisfaction. But now that's not Jung's idea of sublimation at all. In fact, you could say this is one of the real main you know, they had this basic theoretical agreement, but this is one of the practical places where you can see it comes down to a great difference in the way you do therapy. And that is Jung's idea, is that that higher thing is already there to begin with. That's what is desired. But it's not known in its higher form. Either because when it tried to surface as a child, it was repressed. Or because it was never... it was, I don't know, how can I say it? Because there has never been, either in the person's life or in their time, a way to bring it to its higher form, to its true form. So for Freud, you start with the low and you get the higher. For Jung, the higher is there first. And because it can't be known, it creates itself in a low form. That's what this text is. Her idea is that wisdom is the desired end. But because there has been no way to conceive of wisdom, she could not present herself directly. She has to present herself indirectly. And she presents herself indirectly in this low form of that instinctive onslaught that we talked about. So sublimation for Freud is causal. For Jung, it's teleological.
Right. So, I mean, in coming here, I mean, because you're bypassing the liquid state, what does that mean?
I don't think that's not the main point. No.
Okay, so the main thing is just understanding it's already...
Goes from a lower level to a higher level.
What was the word you just said about Jung?
Teleological, goal-oriented.
Say it again.
T-E-L-E-O, teleo,
okay.
Logical, goal-oriented. Telos is the Greek word for goal.
Okay.
Teleological.
And you say Freud is causal?
Causal. Telephone? Oh.
back to your joke.
Something else I was going to say. The way I put it sort of a little crassly, but I think maybe it will help, is that for Freud, the past causes the future. But for Jung, the future causes the past. There's something out there that wants to be achieved in my life. And because it is not known, it surfaces in the present in a low form, which is generally a distressing situation. And by working on that present low form, I give the future its chance to come into being. Yeah. Great, great difference. For sublimation in psychoanalytic jargon, I think, generally has this idea of second best. You know, Leonardo painted, was it Leonardo? The classic one that Freud did was that painting of Saint Anne and Saint...
Cartoonist
Saint Anne? Yeah, which one is it?
It's Cartoonist Saint Anne. It's Anne, the Mother Mary, and it's Mary and the Christ child, and a cherub.
Yeah, and if you look at it with sort of figure ground reversal, there's a vulture in the picture.
Yeah, vulture.
Yeah.
And Freud's thing is, you see, Leonard could never admit his negative mother complex. Hmm? So he's expressing it in a sublimated form in that picture. That's taking it to absurdity.
It might be his left-handedness, too.
His left-handedness, yeah.
Are you talking about a piece that Freud painted?
No, Leonardo painted and Freud interpreted.
So it is, because it is the cartoon of Saint Anne.
Well, and it's the cartoon, but it's also, that cartoon is a study for a full-fledged painting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Leonardo had, I think he had two mothers, didn't he? And that therefore he was unaware of his negative mother complex. And his response is, how many other people have had two mothers with a negative mother complex and they didn't paint that picture? So it's the causal thing Jung does not see is
illegitimate.
But that is, yeah, okay, so it's a dual mother motif. He had one mother and was raised by another. Anyway, that's an important question because really in if you wanted to give this a psychological label, it's about sublimation. But just be sure you understand that there are many different ways of understanding sublimation. And I think sublimation probably because the thing goes from a low state to a high state. And there's such a clear distinction. Yeah, like a mothball. Mothball sublimes. It just slowly evaporates, but it never turns into a liquid. It just goes into a gas.
Well, I think what you said there about the dealing with the distress gives that the low form, getting that, then it gives way to the new.
Yeah, form. See, that's exactly the point. That distress, it's the new thing in a low form. So if you whack up the low form, you whack up the result. That's why it's so dangerous about psychoanalysis. It destroys.
It burns up in the fire then.
It burns.
I'm getting the whole, like,
It takes these problematic situations, which could be a perversion or or a symptom, and it deconstructs them. That's the fashionable word. It sees what is wrong about them, and what Jung tries to do is see what's right about it, and help it reach its full state, not show what's false about it. I think I told you that. I don't know if all of you were in the class, but the classic one, I worked with this guy who was addicted to child pornography. Remember that? We talked about that, I think, one of the classes. And I never, he was a preacher, actually, believe it or not. I never deconstructed it. But over time, to make a long story short, because some of you just heard this several times, it went from that, and then he began to be interested in playing with toys, to become interested in playing war with toy soldiers, to becoming interested in studying about the history of Indiana, to developing a quite an extensive exhibition of the early history of Indiana, which he got state funding for and took on the road. And by that time, the perversion was gone. So that illicit thing was the very first appearance of this later interest, which had no way of surfacing because no one had ever walked him through the consciousness broad enough to receive it. That's sort of the way we kind of work often. So see, you know, that's why the DSM-4 is so viciously destructive. It just puts labels on this behavior. You know, people make whole lives out doing this, and it destroys the spirit. Okay, I think that takes us over. Wait, did I say, but these dark components veil like a garment something super personal? Did I read that? No, okay. This is just saying what I've said in other words. These dark components veil like a grammar something super personal.
Where?
Bottom of 226. Dark components veil like a garment something super personal, which should not be rejected along with them because of their unpleasant aspect. So, see, that's saying what I just said, right? And the garment is the image used for that first state, which you wouldn't know unless you knew the symbolism of alchemy. As the anima figure begs so anxiously for indulgence, we may conjecture that the author was intellectual with a puritanical cast of mind, and then he stood in danger of rejecting the emergent unconscious contents on account of their dubious outer aspect without grasping their underlying meaning. I can think of another. Sometimes it's not always so black and white, but I can think of some people where it's so clear. I remember an anorexic woman. Some of you have heard this too. I mean, she was like, she had been in the hospital. She was so skinny. And she at least put enough weight to get out, not because she wanted to get better, but she hated the hospital. And so she came to me. And again, it's an instinctive reaction not to interpret these things. So I said to myself, enter, why do you need to be anorexic? What is right about your anorexia? You know, they had her making all these journals about how much she was eating, health, and she was throwing. I said, throw the damn things away. You know, if you want to eat and throw up for God's sake, this is ridiculous. Let's find out what is right about your state. And over time, I began more and more to pick up that her husband was crazy, but was calling her crazy. I said, did it ever occur to you that you're making yourself so small that he can't project his craziness onto you? Well, that clicked. He started gaining weight, and guess what? He went insane. Yeah. So see, that anorexia, what was her attempt to not carry his psychotic projections? And with support and realizing there was another way to look at this, she could get bigger. Of course, then he then started to belittle her, which is how you make people psychotic. And she stood her ground and eventually left him, and he went crazy.
Yeah.
That's what we mean by the meaning of a symptom. It needs to be, and it's so the anorexia would be the garment. And the future content would be genuine self-confidence. And as you know, anorexia is almost like fashionable these days. And it's scary, and I think this might be part of it. People are just trying to make themselves small because the world is so toxic.
Could you go the opposite way with weight?
Mm-hmm.
As being a garment, hiding
mm-hmm.
something?
Mm-hmm.
Or,
mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I think you can apply this to all symptomology.
That we think of as negative?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All is probably a dangerous word, but much, much, much. The practical danger is, what do you do with somebody like, actually, thank God she terminated with me before she started this behavior, but she was seeing someone else. I don't know what they did, but this woman just went sort of nuts, and what stood out of Westfield Boulevard, flashing everybody in underwear and getting laid. I don't particularly care about the sexual behavior, but you can get AIDS and die, that kind of thing. So you see, you can't, at that point, you can't. You have to take a stand and say, look, this is destructive, stop it. Because if you don't, the consequences of the person's behavior could destroy them. But as much as possible, the words we use is we try not to pathologize. Okay. So, is that okay? The next passage is on page 27. Let's see, in our study guide, we're over on page 6. And shall not defile with fornication the couch of my rest. So see, couch is the key word there. Now, you don't know that as an alchemical reference unless you know alchemy backwards and forwards, but it does. Shall not, you don't realize that couch is also an alchemical reference unless you know alchemical symbolism as well as she does. We'll see that as an alchemical reference. Not unlike the garment. And shall not violate my whole body, which is exceedingly delicate, and above all my soul, or dove. So dove is going to be another image. Without gall, gall will be another image, is wholly beauteous and comely, in which there is no spot. Who shall not do hurt to my seats and thrones? The couch that is not to be defiled has much the same meaning as the garment. It's a symbol for the distilling vessel. To go down a little further, should not be cracked by overheating. What's it mean to crack the vessel? Well, first of all, what is the vessel? What's it mean to crack it? And this will be the alchemical vessel, of course. What's it mean to crack it? And what's it mean to overheat it? Yeah, the overheating would be saying things to people in a delicate situation, which create more emotion than they can handle.
Or in your own walk, too.
Or in yourself, yeah.
Pushing too fast.
Pushing too fast. What's the vessel?
Ego.
Okay.
So what did you say?
Ego. Can you say a little bit more?
Persona or whatever, the thing that is trying to be, the prima materia that's trying to be transformed. You can't overheat it and crack it, otherwise you won't achieve the objective. And if ego is subjected to the contents of the unconscious unfiltered form, if it's directly exposed to it, it'll crack.
Yeah.
It'll crack up.
Pop a gasket. The vessel would be the ego attitude that constantly observes the experience that's occurring and doesn't act it out. The vessel would be an ego, I would say an ego attitude, not just the ego. It's an ego attitude. And that attitude, if you think of a biblical passage, which might help to explain this, it's one of my favorite Bible passages. I don't have many of them, but this one is when Jacob is wrestling with the angel. And, they wrestle all night, and then the angel says, "Okay, I quit." And Jacob says, "No, you don't. I won't let you go until you bless me." Right. So that's the vessel attitude. The vessel attitude says, "I am currently suffering in a certain situation." I mean, and generally, it's first, of course, seen as an objective situation. And then later you realize it's an inner situation, because the emotions that you're carrying tell you that this has got something very important to communicate to you. So the vessel, the idea of keeping something in the vessel, would be keeping your awareness on that experience as long as you are feeling it. Now, of course, in our work, what we do then is say, now write down your dreams, so that you are carrying this emotion, which practically might mean you have to change the way you live your daily life. You know, withdraw a bit and give yourself time. This takes an enormous amount of energy. You see that with people who are physically ill and try to go through this, their bodies just don't support it. It takes an enormous strength, and it takes a lot of energy just to live in that, either the desirousness or the rage or the resentment, or the revenge, the lust, whatever affective state has been activated in you, you have to let it exist. You can't repress it, and you can't act it out. Both are dangerous. And the vessel attitude is this third way of containing it, but not expressing it and not repressing it. It is very difficult.
I just had a friend that just had a dream that he was given, he doesn't know what it meant, but he was given a third way.
Well, he's probably going through an emotional experience that he needs to incubate, might be a word. Now, our idea, of course, is in that period that if you are, and here is the big word, which is like a swear word, if I use the F word in public, nobody gets upset. If I say this word in public, people get really upset. Responsible. Responsible. That seems to get people madder than any four-letter word you can think of. If you can be responsible about it. See, which is why we make such a fuss over watching the details of the therapeutic interaction. Does the person come regularly? Do they pay regularly? Is there an ego there that can be responsible to the outer world and therefore has as a sign that they will be responsible to the inner world? And believe me, that is not to be taken for granted. I spend half my time working on people's responsibility to the outer world. Because if they can't be responsible to the outer world, they'll never be able to stand this fire. They will either squash it or they'll act it out. I was just talking to a guy.
How do you stay in the fire?
Huh?
How do you stay in the fire? Just by observing it?
By being still.
Being still.
I mean, I just give you an example where it actually was a mistake of mine, but I was working with a guy who was, I met his wife and I thought, oh my God, you are lethal. And the guy, sure enough, came down with cancer. And I could see the wife was just slowly killing this guy. And he opted after the surgery for no further treatment. Well, he's going to die. And in a way, against my better judgment, against this sort of awareness, but just thinking, this guy's headed for death. I said to him, listen, this is going to be hard for you to hear, but I think your wife is killing you. You know what he did? He went home and told her I said that.
Oh.
She took off her marriage ring. He terminated the work. He's going to die. He couldn't hold the suffering that would have come with that awareness. So see, that's breaking the vessel. In a way, you could criticize me for telling him because he wasn't ready to carry that awareness. But I did so thinking, well, the alternative is he's going to die anyway. Because it was a very, like, stage 2-3 melanoma. And he opted for no further chemo or radiation. Now, come on, the chances are very, very slim. He's going to survive a couple of years. But that's an example of how the vessel is broken. And in his case, to have kept the vessel closed would have meant living with that very upsetting emotion. And I don't at all think it would have been hopeless. You see, then if he could have lived with that emotion, he could have gotten his wife into counseling. I mean, but he did an either or action, and she basically said, if you can get therapy, I'm going to divorce you, and he terminated it.
And would have been breaking the vessel if he had realized that himself.
Well, he couldn't realize it himself.
Okay.
I don't know why, but he couldn't. I mean, here I think you probably could explain it as he had a very overpowering mother, and he just didn't see the devious side of women. Very, very naive guy. A likable guy, but just very, very naive. And so the idea is that if you can carry this emotion, the dreams will begin to show you where it's headed. That's the vessel. And if you act it out, or if you pretend it doesn't exist, then you cut the psyche's. But when you're holding this suffering state and just living with it day after day after day, and not allowing it to turn into behavior, then the psyche starts generating these images which move you forward. That's what it means to cook alchemically.
Your last session, you were talking about that slow, steady heat business, and you said, which is what this seems to be describing for the process, and you were saying it doesn't work that way, that in fact there are these emotional flare-ups, and that things boil over, and then you gotta pop things down. So, I don't know, it seems contradictory.
Well, it just sounds so neat, slow, steady heat, you know, like sautéing or something.
Well, yeah.
But that is, it's more like baking at a pretty high temperature for a long time.
Well, I said, you know, how can you boil a frog, not by, you know, sticking the wood jump out, but slowly increasing.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I have
to want to boil a frog or anything.
In a way, I've contradicted myself. But
eels work that way, too.
Eels?
Mm-hmm.
I was reacting more to the sense that it's comfortable. Slow, steady heat implies comfortable.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are we on 228 yet?
No. Nope. We're still dealing with... I want to get this idea of the vessel very, very, very clear.
Okay.
Yeah, Chris, that was an example of the cracked vessel. I think I told this story to the woman who found out her husband was having an affair. And she was seeing another therapist who said, "We have to go tell that other woman how you feel about it." See, this was not paying attention to the vessel. Even I would have known not to do that. So she went over and knocked on the woman's door, and the woman came to the door, and she punched her in the face. Got thrown in jail. See, that's a broken vessel as well, where there was a terrific amount of emotion, upset, rage, jealousy, hurt, which just needed to be endured. And then a way found, as the dreams begin responding to that emotion, to deal with the situation so that it's a win-win situation. Generally, if it's acted out, in other words, if the vessel is broken, it's a lose-lose situation.
And what are some of the things as far as being still that you talk of?
Well, I just tell people very simply, look, you're cooking, mm-hmm. and there are two dangers. One, that you will turn this emotion into behavior so that, you will, if it's a sexual thing, you'll act on it. If it's a hostility thing, that you'll act on it. Even just talking about it very often is a crack in the vessel, because it releases the suffering, and you need to be suffering. So I just say, don't act it out. Don't pretend this doesn't exist. And then I try to explain in a way that we've talked about here what this is about. And then, you see, if you can just sit with it, then we watch the dreams. The dreams will symbolize it, and the dreams will lead.
You talk about not doing anything, not meditating or anything, just talking about being with the
self. Well, if you read Jung's autobiography, mm-hmm. when he was going through this, it was so overpowering. He thought he was going to crack up. So he did Buddhist meditation to calm the emotions down. I don't think that's wrong, and I do say to people, look, I really don't like having dead clients. So if it's too much, please don't shoot yourself. Go see a movie. And I think it's okay to know how much you can and can't take, and then to do things which are pleasurable and harmless to forget about it for a while. But basically to try and stay with it. And then in the analytic work, to watch how the dreams pick up on it. Yeah.
So is this cooking like incubating?
It's incubating. You see, it feels, you don't feel like you're incubating, but you are. And you are carrying the suffering of the unconscious. So the unconscious can begin to do its job to create for you the future, which will be the resolution of whatever you're going through. So important. And I don't think, I don't know other schools of therapy that do this, to understand that what the ego has to do is be a vessel, and then you turn it over to the unconscious and let it take the way. I've often liked that Chinese phrase, wu wei, which means actively non-doing. It's a non-doing, but it's an actively non-doing. And you have to realize this isn't going to last forever, but it may last a month, 2 months, 6 months, a year, till the thing is resolved. Yeah.
Now, would you say in this state, one shouldn't journal?
Oh, definitely should journal.
Should journal.
Most definitely.
So that'd be a way also.
Most definitely.
To get to the unconscious.
Most definitely journal.
And not even share necessarily.
It's very delicate, because people can say things to discourage you.
Yeah.
Not
mean it.
Yeah.
Since I was doing so much journaling and writing on a forum, so I had that dream, remember the dream I had a year ago. And I haven't been able to really write on the forum since, it's just felt very private.
Yeah.
It's been perfect, something really.
Well, I find when I've gone through those things, I find it helpful to journal how bad I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. And that somehow legitimizes it. And then watch very closely what the unconscious is doing, and write down every snippet of a dream. And because sometimes the clues come in the silliest images. Like, how would you know that garment meant something specific? How would you know that couch? You might just have a dream of a couch. You might have a dream of a garment. How would you know? So all I tell people, please, write down everything. And we don't have to talk about it, but I would like to see it, because I might see something in it you don't. Yeah. Okay, so very important, I think. Vessel, not overheating, and not cracking. Oh, yeah, he does say something which is interesting. The seats and thrones are attached to have a similar meaning. See where I am?
No.
Halfway in that second set, in that lower paragraph. Seats and thrones are attached to have a similar meaning in the explanation of the figure of Hermes sitting on a cathedra, stone or teacher's chair. Senior says that the cathedra is the vessel and the place of transformation. Well, interestingly, so are dreams of cathedrals. What people often dream of when they're in this vessel state is that they're in the Mass. You see, what's the Mass but a transubstantiation? But there's always a twist. Now, you know, if I had 2 lifetimes, I think that's something I would work on. And I wish I would have collected them. But, and there's always a twist. And there's always some vulgarity in the Mass. Like Jesus comes out and takes a pee, or somebody's making love on the altar. It's as if the unconscious is taking that sacred image and trying to expand it out. So I think that's a real place where you can see the evolution of the myth in these dreams. And sure enough, they occur when people are going through this cooking. Which would make sense, because we've seen that this cooking is, as we're working with it in this story, part of the evolution of the religious consciousness. This is what's being asked of us, that we work with the instinct and the spirit together, and this is how you do it.